All right, it is. There we go, there we go. It's now 10 o'clock, and it is time to begin our general membership meeting of the Silicon Valley Council of the Blind for the month of November 2016. Welcome, everyone. Thank you for making it out in the weather and the transportation craziness that we're all facing. We will begin, as we always do, with introductions, and then we will introduce our program speaker. We've had a change in program speaker today, and I think you're going to be delightfully surprised. I'll keep that under my, or up my sleeve for just a couple few more seconds. I am Susan Glass. I am president of the Silicon Valley Council of the Blind, newsletter editor, and I'm here with my guide dog, Zeus.
Here.
Okay.
Good morning.
Is it working?
Hello? No. Should be on. Check that. Right here. Let me see that. There we go. Hi. Good morning. This is Alice Turner now, since I'm married to Rob. And vice president as of today. We'll see what happens after elections. No, I'm only kidding. And here with my guide dog, Cora.
Hi. Hi, good morning. This is Vic Clifford.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Welcome back. Hi, I'm Mike Keithley from Mountain View. I'm the membership chair, legislation chair. Also chair of the publications committee.
There you go.
Oh. Should I get started or what?
Yeah, no, just introduce yourself.
Oh.
Who are you?
I'm Mark Ulitsky from Pleasanton, and I'll be talking a little bit later.
Yep. And tell us who you're with.
New guide.
Oh.
Well, he's been.
And I'm with my guide dog, Salem. I just graduated the end of October. And also with my father-in-law, who graduated a long time ago.
Love it.
That's Don Wilcox, let's see, emeritus everything.
Emerita.
Emerita, excuse me.
It's emerita. This is Roger Peterson from Mountain View, and I graduated a long time too ago, too.
Good morning. This is Carol Silveria, and I'm from San Jose.
Good morning. It's Naomi, a hospitality chair, and whatever else I do. From San Jose.
Corresponding secretary.
Rob McGrath. Oh, no, it doesn't work that way.
There you go.
Hi, this is Donna, and I'm the lunch chair.
I'm going to hear Rob's last name.
Hi there. You got Charlie Stein on the line, otherwise known as the Crusher from Palo Alto.
Good morning, everyone. This is John Canzi here, and I'd like to welcome everybody to the final meeting of the Silicon Valley Council of the Blind, believe it or not, of 2016.
Lupi Medrano, San Jose.
I'm Anna Bellino with my guide dog, Tacoma.
Alan Jones from Santa Clara.
It's Michelle and Garvey, fundraising chair, and we're in Mountain View. And by the way, Garvey is now 12 years old.
Oh, yay!
Thank you. Cannie Loomis from Campbell, and Donna, whatever else you do, includes sending out the cards and everything else. Thank you very much.
Hello, this is Bev Clifford back from the eight-week trip. I'm from San Jose. I'm Goody's chair, and I'm usually the copy editor of the newsletter, but I have to take a little break because I don't have a computer right now that works.
Hi, I'm John Glass from Saratoga.
John McNulty from Sunnyvale, board member.
So just say your name and where you're from.
Oh, my name is Farhang, F-A-R-H-A-N-G,
This is my very first time here. I just walked off the streets into these doors.
Hi, I'm Patricia Silva from Cupertino. Here you go.
Hi, I'm Patrick from San Jose, and I am a board member, and I'm the chair of the Braille Literacy Committee.
All right. Awesome.
Good morning. My name is Joe Silveria from San Jose. Name, rank, serial number.
Good morning, everybody. This is Ruben Armenta from Santa Clara. I'd like to make a little announcement. I'm going to finally get a dog from Guide Dogs for the Blind. I've been accepted, and I'll be having a new dog, so hopefully I won't be running into people so much, or objects, or falling down. You know, I've kissed a few poles, a lot of poles, you know. But anyway, you know, after the first of the year, I'll have a new dog. So happy holidays, everybody, and have a happy new year.
Awesome. Barbara Dickinson from Mountain View.
Perfect. Kathy Hogue, San Jose.
Awesome.
Ken Hogue, San Jose, taking a back seat to everybody.
John Vandervoort and Guide Dog Chase from San Jose, and I really take the back seat.
Frank?
There you go. Frank Brown, Cupertino. I have my walking cane named Mr. Magoo, and I don't have a title on the board.
Good morning. My name is Rudy Yannett, and I'm a volunteer from San Jose.
Hey, thank you.
I'm Kira, student volunteer from Pali, and I'm about to graduate in the spring.
Okay. Is that everyone?
That's everybody.
All right. Well, welcome, everyone. So, we've had a change in program speaker, but you're going to be delightfully surprised. Nancy Whitney, who was going to come today, had to have a surgery, I think, on her knee, and she's going to be laid up until sometime next year, so we'll get a card out to her. Our speaker today is a very interesting man. He works at the Lawrence Livermore Labs, and before that he worked at the labs in Los Alamos, New Mexico. He has played tennis, and I understand was very good at that. He's also been a skier. He just graduated from Guide Dogs for the Blind and came back with his dog, Salem, and he's also a writer. He has just completed a book, which he calls Leaving Denial Land, and he's going to talk to us a bit about his life and his work and his journey with his visual impairment, and I think he's going to read to us from that book as well. So will you please give a warm welcome to one of our new members who we're just delighted, Mr. Mark Ulinski.
All right, well, thank you for that introduction. So as Susan said, my name is Mark Ulinski, and for those of you that don't know, I have RP, and I was diagnosed, in my early 20s, and basically about a week before I started graduate school. And surprisingly, the doctor there told me that I should just, you know, not even go to graduate school. I should just drop out. And I luckily ignored him and went on to get my PhD. But in doing that, I think I put on some blinders in order to sort of move forward and get through what I needed to do, which was focusing on my education at that point. And so, you know, that helped me in terms of getting my degree, but I think it hurt me emotionally because I didn't really want to deal with any of the feelings that were coming up, you know, especially, feelings of denial, feelings of shame or fear, embarrassment, worrying about what other people were going to think of me if I had a cane or something else. And so, like I said, it was very helpful for me in the short term, but in the long term, it had some consequences. And That's one of the things I decided to write about during, you know, like evenings and weekends over the last year. So Susan said, I'm a scientist at Livermore, and...
Somebody needs to turn off a microphone, I think.
Turn off.
Like your desk, make sure the desk mic is on.
Okay, those are all off now.
Okay.
Oh, okay. Is it better now?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
No, it's not. Is your wireless mic off?
Yeah.
Well, it's really close to the audience this time.
Oh, okay.
Oh. I could move over if you...
You could move right over behind
you. You want to go to the...
Okay.
Put you at the head table.
Oh, yeah, that's better.
Yeah.
Just stay right there.
Stay right there.
Just come over to this table.
You come, there's a nice table right here.
Okay.
There's a chair behind you.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
There you go.
Now we hear you.
So is that better now? Can you hear me now? I could work for Verizon. Okay. So I'm a scientist at Livermore. I won't go too much into the technical work because it would probably put everyone to sleep, except maybe Roger. But Livermore has the world's most powerful laser right now. And some of the experiments they're doing are basically trying to mimic what happens in the sun, where you get all of this energy produced from, you know, nuclear fusion. And if they can do that, you know, then that would be an enormous way of getting clean energy and putting in a little bit of energy into the laser and getting a huge amount of energy in terms of the nuclear reactions. But no one in the world has figured out how to do that yet, and at Livermore they're still struggling with trying to get that. Now, I don't work on experiments, which is good because of my vision, but I do work on a computer code that tries to model the experiments that they're doing. And so I work on different physics packages, like trying to model the turbulence, trying to model some of the radiation properties and some of the conductivity properties. And so it's a huge effort, and I work with about maybe 12 other physicists and 12 other computer scientists. And we run this code on hundreds of thousands of processors because the resolution is, you're trying to model this thing in such detail that you need really the most powerful computers in the world. And so it's a lot of fun, but very very challenging as well. And because part of the work I do is classified, I had some interesting issues in trying to get Salem into the into the lab.
She would tell, right?
Well, you know, there are a lot of smart people there, and a lot of times they can get a little paranoid because they're so smart. And so they were worried that the dog had a chip, you know, and that somehow the chip was going to transmit classified information. And so my argument to that was, I heard that, and I was like, well, I don't think that's an issue because it's a passive chip. And And
okay, we're moving the table over because Dog Salem wants to get back to you.
Oh.
So you just moved the whole table to work.
Well, Salem is very strong, actually, as it turns out. Okay.
But he doesn't know where you are.
Stay.
Yeah, I...
Down.
It's okay. So. Salem doesn't want to be closer to me. He wants to be closer to the other guide dogs. Okay, tell him sit. Tell him down. There we go. Okay. Salem is very social, and for those of you I haven't told, he actually went to high school because his puppy raiser was a high school senior. So he's a very social dog. I had to deal with a lot of issues in terms of security. And then there was people from the environmental health division saying, well, what happens if your dog has an accident? You know, how are you going to clean that up? And they said, well, we recommend that you use this bleach solution and blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, whatever you want me to do is fine. And then someone said, oh, but you're not allowed to bring bleach into the lab because that's a hazardous chemical. And so I had a lot of very interesting, you know, issues in terms of just... just trying to get Salem settled into a normal office environment because I just work on the computer. I don't do anything crazy.
Oopsie, that's okay. You know what? I have a suggestion. I will be glad to hold Salem for you because I think it's hard for you to talk in it.
Oh, that's okay. I've got him between my legs now, so so he's not going to move anywhere.
Okay. Okay.
So one of the things with a guide dog is you have all sorts of distractions that you never had with just a white cane, as it turns out. So, like Susan said, I've actually spent about maybe 8 months or so working on a book that talks about my issues and what I've experienced in terms of sort of pre-diagnosis, diagnosis, and then what's happened more recently. But I've tried to focus more on a lot of the emotional issues that, you know, that I've gone through and I think are probably pretty similar for anyone who has a visual issue or any kind of, you know, disability or issue that makes them feel like they're not fitting in. And so my hope is that I can read you a short section that has to do with when someone first told me that they thought I should get a guide dog. Because as it just so happens, I was not open to the idea at that point in my life. But let me start with my favorite sentence from the book here, which...
Still having that stupid feedback.
Hey, Rob.
Rob, can you help?
Can you get go up there and...
So is it just one mic that's turned on?
Yeah.
I'm right here.
Can you scroll with your left hand and then hold the mic in the right hand possibly? Or I can hold the mic for you. Yeah. Instead and see if that
takes Susan's stance.
Oh yeah.
And then you have to turn it on and turn that other mic.
You hear me now? Okay. All right, so hopefully this won't have all the feedback. Okay. So my favorite sentence, I saved it for the last chapter, and I said, "One reason I am writing this book is so that others in a similar position can learn from my mistakes. I have made many, so there's really a lot to be learned here." Oh, are we still good here with this? Okay. All right. Okay, so what I thought I would do is share with you my experience when someone first mentioned that I should get a guide dog, because I think you'll find that rather humorous. And maybe, you know, hopefully you'll be able to relate to it, some of you who have a guide dog or who are thinking about it. All right, and recall that you haven't read the previous part, so, you know, if I refer to things, just assume that I've written about those already. So if you thought that my resistance to using Uber, attending a meditation class, going through white cane training, or seeking out a support group was over the top, you hadn't seen anything yet. When my wife first suggested that I consider getting a guide dog, I went through the roof. I put up walls that Donald Trump would have been proud of. Now, I wrote this 8 months ago, so I didn't know what was going to happen. But nothing was getting through, baby. Just the idea of thinking about a guide dog made me extremely uncomfortable. Guide dogs are for blind people, I remember saying. I'm not completely blind. I'm just legally blind. There's a huge difference. I've only just started getting comfortable using my white cane, and now you want me to get a guide dog? Are you crazy? And these verbal gems were only uttered after I had calmed down enough to start forming coherent sounds with my mouth. I should have known by now, after almost 13 years of marriage. I should have raised my white flag or white cane in surrender and thrown in the proverbial towel. The next thing I knew, my wife had a phone number for me to call. Through some 5 degrees of separation, she had a friend who had a client who had a something, which eventually led to a guide dog with a man with a phone number. All right, I'll call him. And so I did eventually during my lunch break at work. So he told me about Guide Dogs for the Blind School in San Rafael, a city just north of San Francisco. He said that resistance was normal and that his wife had even started the application process without his knowledge. Now that's pretty clever. But it was all worth it, he said. And he had a new sense of independence, freedom, and friendship. He explained to me a little about the process of applying and some of the steps involved. But at the time, I was only hearing what I wanted to hear. This guy was almost completely blind and worked from home. If I worked from home, then having a dog would not be a big deal. I wouldn't stand out in any way in front of my coworkers, and I could stay partly in that magical place called Denial Land, which should not be confused with Disneyland, the happiest place on earth. If I were at work, I wouldn't be able to fold my dog up into a nice compact shape and stick him or her into my backpack like I did with my cane. Plus, I spent hours sitting in my office on the computer all day. What was the dog going to do other than die of boredom? So despite these negative thoughts, I decided that I would check out the website. My wife wasn't going to let me off the hook that easily, and so I needed to come up with some anti-dog ammunition. I discovered that a few times a year, the school offered guide dog lifestyle workshops. These workshops seemed directly targeted at me, as they discussed what was involved with having a dog, how working with a dog was different than using a cane, how the application process got started, how the 2-week training program worked if the application was approved, and other issues of interest and information for people considering working with a guide dog. There would even be a simulated walk with the dog followed by a real walk. I shared this info with my wife and told her that there was a workshop in just a few days' time, and then there would be another one a few months later. Given my schedule and my wife's even busier one, I thought that the class offered a few months from now would be just perfect. This thinking again shows what a complete fool I am, because before I even came home from work, my wife had already moved all of her clients for the upcoming class date and told me to call, make reservations, and get whatever info I needed so that we could attend the class that was only a few days away. Although I really didn't want to be there and acknowledge that a service dog might be in my future, I have to admit that the workshop was incredible and really well organized. Most of the people attending and thinking about getting guide dogs were in fact completely blind. I didn't appreciate at the time how fortunate I was to have a slowly degenerative eye condition. The slow decline had worked in my favor and allowed me to complete my education, do a postdoc, and obtain a good job. The completely blind teenagers and 20-somethings didn't necessarily have this opportunity, and it would definitely be a lot harder for them. So in reality, I had a lot to be grateful for. I also couldn't believe the information that was being passed to me. The 2-week training and living on the on-site dorms was free, and the vet care was also heavily subsidized so that the cost to the individual receiving the guide dog would be minimal. The puppy raisers, who did all of the birth to about a year-old training, were an integral part of the process and attended the graduation ceremonies held every other Saturday. If I had a trip to go on where bringing my dog would be difficult, then they had an on-site kennel that would take care of the dog for free while I was on business or vacation. And after graduation, the learning and training process didn't stop just there, and guide dog trainers from the school would visit your home periodically to fine-tune any issues that were cropping up and needed to be dealt with. It was extremely impressive, and I was overwhelmed. I had started with my walls of resistance, and after the workshop, I could actually see myself using a dog. I do remember that after lunch, we did a Juno walk, where Juno is the name of the imaginary dog that is pulling you. Basically, you act like you're with a dog, but you're really just holding onto a harness and learning the proper technique for turning, stopping, and such, while the trainer is grasping the other end of the harness. This Juno walk was then followed by a real guide dog walk, which was very different than the calm and steady Juno one. The dog, whose name I now forget, didn't look too big, but she was all muscle. Yeah. It felt like I was in Alaska on a sled being pulled by wolves. The dog's only goal was to get me to the end of the path so that she could get her treat. And this and this dog was highly motivated. That was quite the experience. After everyone else who was interested had a chance to do the Juno and guide dog walks, the woman running the workshop decided to take us over to where the dormitory was located. She gave some basic directions, and then the completely blind individuals all rose from their chairs and started utilizing their white canes. Normally, I'm the only person using a white cane when I walk, and so it was very surreal for me to stand back and witness 10 canes moving back and forth in close proximity like weed whackers or machetes. Is that what I look like, I thought? Hanging well back and away from the line of fire or kill zone. There has to be a more elegant point or a more elegant way to get from point A to point B. And so there was. The workshop leader, who like me still had some useful vision, followed behind with her dog in a very easy, non-threatening to other pedestrians manner. Problem solved. So that was my part one of getting a guide dog.
Beautiful.
And I have a part two and a part three that I won't share, but then I also talk about, you know, that I basically had a sort of a diary of the 2 weeks I was there. And anyway, and then like I said, I there's a lot of stuff in here. It's probably like 90 pages, so I don't want to bore everyone with 90 pages. But Susan has kindly offered to sort of help me proofread it and give me any feedback.
I don't think you're going to need much.
Well, I will take anything I can get.
It's really solid.
But yeah, it really just shows that, you know, when someone makes a suggestion to you about, you know, a white cane, about going to a support group or anything, and you become totally incoherent, then yeah, that sort of is a good clue that there's some resistance. And like I said, I've been through, if there's an easy way and a hard way to go through vision loss, and I've definitely chosen the hard way, but I don't think I've met anyone who's chosen the easy way yet. And so I'm still waiting to meet that person who is so proactive about doing all the things that, you know, they should do exactly when they should do them. And that's a very rare, I think that's a very rare person. And so I'm happy to answer any questions if anyone has any questions.
Yeah, open to questions.
I have a question.
Hey, we're going to get a mic to you.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Yeah, I'd like to learn a little bit more about your access technology and the platform that you use.
They have to kill you.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
how do you do your programming?
Yeah, so I guess the truth is I haven't made use of a lot of the adaptations or technology that's out there, because when I had someone from, I think it was called Adaptive Services Technologies in San Francisco. So they told me that, you know, again, I'm basically seeing really well, but I'm seeing like, you know, you're looking through a straw or something. So I'm seeing something really well, and so... So they told me that there wasn't, you know, the magnifiers and things they had really wouldn't help me. And so what I've done is I've made my fonts larger and I've changed the colors to make the contrast better so it's easier, you know, easier on my eyes. But I haven't, you know, made use of the technology because they said my vision was too good to use a lot of their equipment. And so for me, it's really making the fonts bigger, you know, using VoiceOver for emails to go through them a little faster.
Still have something going on.
But yeah, for the programming, I am just, you know, making the contrast in order to help.
Hi, my name is Frank, and I have RP. And from listening to your first chapter, that's pretty cool, because my sister's doing a book on me right now, and she's calling it either Give Me 15 Seconds and I'll Be Fine. And the point behind that title is self-accomplishment makes self-gratification. Because, you know, you like to do things on your own and explain what you see and what you do every day. And we have another title, it's called Blind Victim of Circumstances. And that now tells stories about what happened to you by yourself when you're going blind or and being blind. And my climax in life and motivation, yours was that somebody told you to quit doing graduated work. And that would really tee me off. That would really upset me. But my doctor told me, you shouldn't have kids. And that really burned me up, too. And I got two beautiful kids now, 29 and 26 years old, and they're fine. You know, they go to an ophthalmologist from time to time. But my point is, what I'm saying, the book and writing down how you feel, does it really make you feel more broader in life about yourself going blind? Because I'm 58, and I still have, I say 20% of my sight because I'm a cartoonist by profession. That's my gas. That's my fuel that keeps me going every day. I draw about maybe 3-4 hours a day. But I'm awed by your profession, being a scientist at Livermore. That's way beyond my comprehension to even think about that. So I want to compliment you on your book and your life.
Well, thank you. I think for me, what I've learned is, because I have a family and I actually have three stepchildren, 26, and then twins that are 19. But it turns out that I think sometimes I'm the only one being affected by, you know, my vision loss. And I know that, well, if you read the book, you'll see that my wife actually has a lot of frustration because, you know, in her mind, it's like it's obvious what I need to do and I'm resisting and not wanting to do it. And of course, that's always easier when, you know, the shoe's on the other foot. But, part of the thing to appreciate is, you know, even though, yes, I'm the one that's losing my vision, you know, my actions are affecting the people around me. And if I'm exhausted at the end of the day because I'm not using my cane or I'm not using a dog or, you know, I'm just working so much harder to do what I need to do to be like the other scientists that are at the lab, then when I come home, I don't have a lot of energy, you know, for the family and other people. And so, you know, part of my decision to get the dog and to really use my white cane was just to increase my capacity, you know, and to try to have more energy and to be there for, you know, the people around me. So yeah, I can definitely relate to those book titles that you mentioned. So I just turned 46 on about 2 days ago. And I have about 7 or 8 degrees of central vision in each eye.
It's Susan. Question and a comment, actually. The comment is I resonate so much with what you say about how it's not just our blindness. It becomes part of the whole family. And I know that as the youngest of three siblings and the others could see, that my blindness was a big piece of the family landscape. And it's whenever something happens, you know, it's the whole family who is working with sight and blindness and insight together. And it's always that way, but it's hard to know it when you're the one making the journey. It's very difficult. Yeah. My question is, when you were in school with Salem, to what degree did the trainers, the teachers, encourage you to use your usable vision? Because they've kind of changed their philosophy about that over the years, I understand. And to my way of thinking, I would think any vision that you had is one more tool that you'd want to go ahead and use it. So I was just curious to know how that affected things, or if they were asking you to wear sleep shades, or what was going on with that.
So that's a good question. And, you know, there were 8 students. You know, so there was, you know, me and then 7 other students in the class. And I would say maybe 3 of us still had some useful vision and the other 5 basically had no vision. And they basically told us, you know, you use the vision you have. You know, if you want, we can give you, you know, blindfolds or, you know, like dark sunglasses and you can mimic, you know, what it would be like, you know, to basically not see anything. And so there were a few lessons where I wore my sunglasses. They did a night walk, so we got to, you know, basically be in the downtown during the night and sort of, again, simulate what that would be like. And so, yeah, so I took part in, you know, anything they offered, I basically took part in just so I could experience it. But another reason I decided to get a guide dog now instead of waiting was I thought it would be really much more challenging for me if I waited until I had no vision and then went to get the guide dog instead of sort of learning about all the things I needed to do while I could sort of still, you know, still see and, oh, okay, here's where this leash goes and here's how I attach this. And so that was sort of my motivation, is I wanted to get a feel for dealing with a guide dog, working with a dog, while I could sort of still correct him and, you know, do, you know, see some things that, because the dogs aren't perfect. They make mistakes too, just like we do. But yeah, that was definitely a motivation for me, was to do it sooner rather than later.
Yes, it's Frank again. This is really great. I like what we're talking about today. Now I forgot what I was going to say.
I concur.
Yeah. Well, I'm 58. I just turned 58 a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, okay.
And I didn't think this would ever happen to me. For the person that I am today with RP, I hope you can relate to me, and I think you can. And everybody else here who's going blind with RP and diabetes, glaucoma, is relationship with people around you, you know, longtime old friends. And I still have, we just had a 40-year high school reunion, and I knew a lot of people, and they all knew I was going to eventually lose my sight, because I found out when I was 16 years old. And I went around campus, I'm going blind, I'm going to go blind, you know. And then when they saw me for the first time in 40 years, they said, so, Frank, I think you got a cane in your hand, you know. So, are you blind? I said, no, I'm visually impaired. But the love of my life is my wife. She's my battery that keeps me straight, you know. Sometimes I get derailed, you know. But she puts me back on the track and keeps me straight. I'm curious, you know, is your wife, you know, the main reason why you keep going with RP, or is it your kids, or is it your family, or is it your job? You know, you feel like you have to work, bring home a check, supply the family. You know, there's a lot of things on your mind being blind, you know.
Yeah, so I'd say all of those. I mean, I've basically been supporting a family of five and now four, because our oldest daughter moved out. Yeah, I sometimes feel that that's a lot of pressure, because, you know, I don't know what's going to happen with my vision, and I hope I can keep it as long as possible. But yeah, work is a big motivator. Wife and family is definitely a really big motivator.
Tell us a little more about what the rest of the book covers. We're really going to be excited.
Katie has a question, and then we can...
So, well, here, yeah, I can...
Just let me know.
Maybe I can just sort of read the table of contents so you can get a feel for what some of the topics are that
actually have
that I'm talking about.
Thank you.
Let's see here. Okay, so my chapter one was called Pre-Diagnosis or the Idiot's Guide to Retinitis Pigmentosa Symptoms. And the reason I did that is because, you know, a lot of people, like when I would have my white cane or the dog and I get on the bus to go to work, and then I pull out my Kindle and start, you know, reading on my Kindle where I've made the fonts bigger, they're looking at me like, what on earth are you, you know, you're blind. How could you possibly be reading, you know, and, you know, you have a dog or a white cane. So that was one of the reasons I wanted to sort of cover some basic stuff about, you know, RP and how other people may not be as familiar with that as they would with something that affects your central vision that you know, may be more obvious. And so I have some topics like juggling, which, you know, that was before I knew I had RP, and I couldn't figure out why I couldn't juggle well, even though I had the the Idiot's Guide to Juggling or something like that. I talk about two of the times I broke my nose because, again, I didn't realize I had a visual issue, and so someone was throwing a baseball once, and I sort of turned away for a second, and when I turned back, you know, the ball had smacked me right in the face.
Ouch.
Yeah, then... you know, there were times when I was, so I called it an interesting pizza experience, and there was a time I was with my friend at a restaurant, and it was dark, and he had actually gotten up to go to the bathroom, but I was talking to him because I didn't have the side vision, and so I just assumed he was still there.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, there's those kind of things that happen. Playing racquetball. So if you have RP, you know, I taught tennis, and I'm a really good tennis player. But with racquetball, you have these strange things called, like, a ceiling and sidewalls that the ball can hit. And so as soon as that happens, you can't see the ball at all, or at least I couldn't. And so there was this wondering of, why is it that I can't follow, you know, I can't track this, you know, this ball? And it was, again, before I was diagnosed, this was actually very strange. I also have a section on studying abroad. So again, this was before I was diagnosed. But for my undergrad, I spent a semester in Spain, in Seville. And I did that because I have a grandmother who was from Argentina. And she ended up living with us for several years when her husband died. But my mother had never taught me Spanish because I guess in the early 70s, the theory was, well, you're going to confuse your child, and, you know, that's going to make it harder for him to learn English. And, of course, today they say just the opposite. And so I always felt guilty for not being able to communicate better with my grandmother because she really didn't, you know, she spoke Yiddish and Spanish, obviously. But I couldn't speak, you know, much Yiddish or Spanish at that time. And so I took some Spanish classes in college. I studied abroad and lived with a Spanish family, had some interesting adventures there, and then came back and got my minor in Spanish, and I got a minor in chemical engineering, and then went to grad school for chemical engineering. And so I talk about, you know, things in Spain. In terms of diagnosis, I talk about, you know, sort of a local optometrist that first referred me to a retinal specialist. I talk about taking visual field tests, which I've always found very depressing because, you know, it's, they keep telling you, well, you click when you see, you know, the light or something, and then if you're going a long time where you're not clicking, then, you know, you start to feel like, oh my, you know, what's wrong with me? Why can't I see, you know, this light? And so that raised a lot of emotional issues for me. And then I talked about hand holders, because when I was in college, you know, there was at Penn State, there was this July 4th celebration. It was like the largest in Pennsylvania. But of course, they only had it at night because, you know, if you're going to see fireworks, you have to wait till it's dark. And so this friend of mine, I would hold on to his girlfriend's hand to take me to where the fireworks were. And at that point, I had never had any mobility instruction. And so I didn't know that, oh, there's actually a way to hold, you know, to properly hold on to someone's elbow to make it easier for them to guide you. You know, I just didn't want to stand out at that point, right? I wanted to look like everyone else. And so that was just something that, again, it would have been helpful if I had had some mobility training or something, you know, earlier on in my life. And then, let's see, chapter 3 is called Struggling. And so there I talk about things like navigating, this will sound very mundane, but navigating through bathrooms and airplanes. And you would not believe that, you know, when I had my white cane, well, so before I had my white cane, if I left it in my seat, say, on the airplane, and I went to the bathroom, and then the stewardess is like, oh, you open the door, there's this thing on the, you know, on the left, and I'm standing there and trying to move back because I need to move back to have more vision. And then there's nowhere to move because you're on this tight airplane. And they're looking at me like, how come you can't open the bathroom door? And so, you know, just all the things that you learn about where, If I had just had my cane with me in the narrow aisle, even though I didn't need it, they would have known, oh, I'll open the door for you. And that would have been, you know, much more helpful. So I've learned a lot about asking for help and having someone walk me to the gate and getting through security just faster. And I don't feel embarrassed about doing that anymore, I can honestly. And then I have a section called Cited or Uncited. And so, you know, if you have RP, you often rationalize that there are all these things you can do that make you cited. And then, yeah, there are things like driving maybe that you can't do that you would say, okay, so I'm uncited because I can't drive or I can't do this or I can't do that. But whenever I did that in the past, I always had this weighted average so that in the end, I always came out more cited than uncited. Yeah. It was amazing. Yeah. And, you know, I think that's part of the denial process is that, you know, if you really are open about what you can do, what you can't do, then, you realize there's a reason why you are, say, legally blind or completely, you know, it's not just some made up, you know, thing. It's a real legitimate diagnosis. So I talk about driving, which was my first experience with Uber and fighting with my wife over using Uber. And I've used Uber a lot, but the first time I used it, which was in San Francisco, at like right outside Montgomery Station, it was total chaos. And my wife, who's fully sighted, was not able to find the Uber car. And so it was a very bad first experience that I had with Uber, where we ended up having to take a taxi. But after that, yes, I've used Uber probably like 50 or 60 times since then. And then I have a section on a support group. And for, I don't know, a few months or maybe a year, I was going to a support group in Berkeley. But something that I found very frustrating with support groups is most of the support groups for visually impaired people assume that you're not working. So all of the groups were meeting, oh, we meet at 10 in the morning on Tuesday, or we meet at 3 o'clock on Friday, or it's like, we're doing a tour of this museum at 11 o'clock on Wednesday, can you make it? It's like, no, I'm working. So that's something that I've really struggled with is, you know, why are there no support groups for people who are visually impaired but work? And that's, I think, something that needs to change. The other thing is that because I was working at Livermore, so I would leave work early, I would take a bus to go from Livermore to the BART station, then I would go to the BART and get on, you know, the blue line, then I'd have to change to the orange or the red line to get to Berkeley, then have to walk like a half hour to get to Minor Hall, which is where the low vision clinic was, and that's where the support groups were. And so by the time I did that, I was so exhausted and drained. And then we had our meeting from 4:30 to 6. Then I had to go back to the BART station, come home. And so I would get home at like 8:30 at night, and I hadn't had dinner. And now I was just totally dead, and then I had to go to work the next day. And so, that support group was actually really good, but just the location and everything was making it really hard. Then I have an interlude I call Fear, where I talk about, well, you can imagine what that sort of self-explanatory. And then the next chapter is called Moving Towards Acceptance. And there I talk about, you know, where I got comfortable using my white cane. I talk about my parents' choices because, you know, the truth is my parents haven't been supportive in the way that I've needed them to be supportive. They've been supportive in the way that is comfortable for them, which for my mother has been feeling very guilty about giving me an eye condition. It's been about not wanting to talk about anything. And for my father, it's been about wanting to get on the internet and email me article after article about, oh, look, here's some study they're doing in Germany, or here's something they're doing in Israel. And it's like, well, that's wonderful. Is there anything viable now that you're in? No, but it's just, you know, it makes him feel better to think that, oh, there's all these things out there. Maybe one of them can help you. And so, you know, one of the things I talk about here is, you know, it really would help for parents of visually impaired people to have some therapy or to have some counseling so that they can be there for the person going through the issue, right? Because the person going through the issue isn't going to want to deal with a lot of the issues. And so you need people around you who are sort of really focused and understand, you know, here's what I need to do, and I need to do it the way that's going to help you, not the way that's going to make me feel better, right? And so I think that's part of the issue. Chapter 5 is called An Unexpected Twist, and that's where I had some gene testing done, and they found my mutation. I talk more about guide dogs. I talk about something called the fear sandwich, which is sort of fear, you know, nestled with anxiety and other emotions to make something not very delectable that you'd want to eat. I did something called a soul journey. So I worked with someone who does like energy work, like Reiki and drumming. And that led me again to uncover a bunch of fear about losing my, you know, losing my family, or that people wouldn't want to, you know, be with me. And just all of my fears and anxiety sort of came up while I took this soul journey. And I described that and the different places that I went to and what I learned from that. And then I even have a section called A Picnic and a Meeting, which is my first, the first SVCB meeting I went to in October, and the summer picnic. And then chapter 6 is guide dog training, where I talk about, you know, the first week and the second week and all the adventures that Salem and I had, especially when he threw up a wood chip one night and scared me half to death. and then final thoughts, where I just try to summarize, you know, again, what I've learned and what I've gone through. And so, yes, I'm happy to email it to anyone, you know, who's interested. So, or I can email it to Susan, and Susan can send it to whoever.
More than that, this is a book that can teach the rehab community. It can teach sighted people. Yes. I mean, there's so much. I'm thinking
you should really be using a microphone.
Yeah,
right.
Take it for it.
Oh. She just got excited. Yeah. That's all. Yeah.
Here's the
microphone. Well, here's one. Here's a portable one.
Okay. Sorry. So, now, does it work?
Is it talking?
It should work.
No.
Oh, Susan, the other mic.
Oh, that one's having trouble.
That one's okay. The stand. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I did, Michelle. I got all excited and messed up. This book will teach the rehab community, people who have no idea, you know, often what we're going through, what we're feeling. It teaches sighted people. It teaches family members. You have hit a gold mine of opportunity here, and I'm, my wheels are turning. I'm thinking, okay, how can we help you market this, because this is huge.
So just I need to find a publisher.
Well, we do, and we need to, and you know, I'm thinking about ACB and publications. Yeah. And National Braille Press, and we got some work to do here, but this is amazing. And it, the stuff that came up just listening to you talk, I think everyone would agree here, is just enormous and huge. Huge.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Wait, we have some people on questions.
Okay, we've got about 8 minutes for questions.
Okay, and I've been waiting for a while, so
I
she
know,
said go
sorry.
Ahead. It's okay. first of all, thank you. I don't have RP, but I do have conditions that progress, and it is difficult sometimes to deal with family and everybody else. And you're right, Susan, a lot of times they don't get it. But one of the questions I had was, when you were first diagnosed, were you, you said you were in your 20s?
Yes.
So you had already gone through, I guess, like you said, most of your schooling. How did you handle getting through the rest of it? Or had you actually graduated by the time you finished off all of that, in terms of like your assistive technology or things like that?
Yeah, so when I was diagnosed, I had finished my undergraduate education, and I was about 1 week away from starting graduate school. And like I said, I, you know, after the doctor told me to drop out and I ignored him, I just sort of said, well, I'm just going to do things the way I've been doing them, because, you know, yesterday I didn't even know that I had this condition, and when I bumped into stuff, it never bothered me. But now, when I started bumping into stuff, it bothered me, because I knew the reason and what, you know, potentially could happen. And so, you know, that's where that ignorance is bliss is sometimes, you know, sometimes that can be true. But, yeah, the truth is I really didn't start dealing with my issue other than letting, you know, people know that I had this. I really didn't do anything technology-wise to deal with it until later. You know, again, when I made fonts bigger, when I, you know, the hardest thing for me is finding where the mouse is on the screen, so I have to, you know, move it into some corner or something so I can see it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think I was very lucky in the sense that, you know, if I had lost my vision while I was much younger, then that would have made my educational experience, you know, much more challenging.
Or different.
Different.
Yeah,
I would have learned Braille and other stuff. So I haven't learned Braille yet. And again, part of that is I took a class in pre-Braille, and oh my God, even that was hard for me.
Well, when I went to school, they said unless you're going to lose your sight totally, they didn't even bother to teach it. And I think there's still some places that are like that. Hopefully, it's getting better, but there's still a lot of places that were like that. At least when I started school.
It is getting better.
Well, and you know, at the school I was at, you know, I didn't realize there were so many apps that people can use. Like, there are apps that will look at your money and tell you, you know, what kind of, you know, bills you have. And so I think the technology recently is really exploding, and there's just a lot of work being done by having, you know, blind people working to develop a lot of these apps. And so that's really helping a lot.
This is Don, and I have the microphone. I just wanted to tell you a couple of things. What you're saying, your experience is very similar to mine with glaucoma. But especially one thing that I had trouble with was I had the imposter syndrome, is what I called it. When I started to know this group and know that people had much, much less vision than I did, and I felt bad because I didn't fit in to this group.
Oh, yeah.
And then when I started to learn to use the white cane, which I really needed to do because I was working and I couldn't get to work, I couldn't go across one street in my neighborhood on my bicycle because in the fall the sun is very low in the sky and I couldn't see into that. So they actually came and taught me cane travel, but before that, I was so embarrassed about that I actually went to my next door neighbor on the corner and apologized to her. I think that I was contaminating her view of the world because they were going to teach me the white cane. I can't. Now it seems really weird that I did that. But there went the neighborhood. They let the blood. But in the end, they taught me how to walk across it. So I had the white cane folded up in the bicycle to that corner, took it out, opened it up, walked across the intersection with the bicycle, put it back in, and went to work. And then, of course, later I needed it a lot more and ended up just walking there. But I found I actually went to a weekend meeting that they had. I'm much, much older than you are. So we had a meeting where they had three social workers, and it was a weekend where people who were just starting to lose their vision all got together up at that. Where's that camp that the lighthouse has? I loved it up there. And I happened to be a nurse, too, so I ended up helping with some of the people. Like some Chinese guy asked me on a walk, "Do you think I could learn how to play the piano?" I said, "Yes." But anyway, we did all that. And I would like to mention to you one thing to help you, is I'm editing a bunch of three news, well, they're updates. They're scientific updates about the cures, but it has a lot more in it, too. And as I'm having more and more difficulty with that, I actually learned Braille just for myself for organization. But I started learning screen readers before I needed them.
Okay.
And I find it really beneficial because I don't have to use my eyes. They get to the point where they're just too tired. And then I'm not married anymore. Thank goodness I'm divorced. But I don't get nearly so tired as when I was trying to do it visually. I can't anymore. So I'm glad that I learned it when I had that amount of vision.
I told you to listen.
And Roger's been telling me ever since I met him 100 years ago, listen, listen. And I still haven't learned that lesson.
Well, yeah, so I've actually been listening to audiobooks a lot more, and so that really helps. But I think one of the interesting things when I was at the training, the two-week training, it was very unusual because, you know, usually I'm the one where people are telling me, oh, you need to go to your right or go to your left, or you left this thing over here and over there. And because me and this one other guy from Arizona, we still had roughly the same amount of vision. And so we're telling people, oh, hey, John, you left your sock in the washing machine, you know, and, you know, your other sock is on the floor. And so, you know, for a blind person to be instructing other blind people, it's a very unique, I've never been in that position before. And so that was I say, you know, this is how my wife must feel when she's looking at me. And so that was a very interesting experience. And yeah, and I think part of the other thing is, I spend so much time being around sighted people because, you know, my family's all sighted, at work everyone is sighted, that I don't know how to interact with people that are completely blind. Like, you know, no one's taught me, well, oh, here's how you sit down and you announce yourself and then you describe on the plate, you know, use the clock to say, oh, your vegetables are at 5 o'clock and you're, you know, this is at, you know. It's like, I didn't know any of those things. You know, no one taught me that.
The food no matter what.
Yeah, exactly. But I found that it was so, I had so little stress at the school because they really cater to knowing that how to deal with people that are blind. And so it was just so relaxing for me. And it was just like, wow, this is really nice. I wish it could always be like that.
Hello, my name is Lupi Medrano. I have RP as well. I was diagnosed at 15 up at Stanford, but when you're told at 15 you're going to go blind someday, you don't believe that because you're fearless at 15. And I married, divorced, had 4 kids, was a blind single mom with my 2 young kids, 4 and 6 years old, and I was always going up against a lot of criticism from my family. I never had an ounce of credit for my family. I only got the credit from school when I started going to De Anza. And I got my AA degree in liberal arts in 02, went to San Jose State and got a BA degree in social work in 05. And I've always been very stubborn, very determined, and I've never let anybody put me down. And I've always been a very faithful person. I'm not religious, I'm faithful. And I've always had a quote-unquote guiding light guiding me everywhere I go. And so I've just don't stop, I go. And I get what I want because that's the way I do stuff. My favorite Frank Sinatra song is, I did it my way. Thank you. I have 9 brothers and 5 sisters, all who are a bunch of idiots because they don't ever know what it's like to be blind.
Wow.
Alice needs a mic, and then we have to stop because we are...
Well, I hope she doesn't want to be president, or Susan, you have to watch out.
Oh, thanks. Okay, just three thoughts. First of all, Mark, thank you, because it's very... I was just listening. I think you opened up an avenue of conversation that we have not had in this chapter for a while, and I thank you for doing that. The second thing is having the gift of putting... emotions and experiences in writing and adding humor is wonderful. And I know that we can, you know, we're going to help to see how it is that you can, you know, get your things published. We really, really, really appreciate that. And my last point is that working and hanging out and getting to know other people who are also visually impaired, as you're doing now, will open up a whole nother avenue for you. So I am so grateful that you're a member of this chapter.
Oh, well, I'm very grateful, too. Thank you.
And that is all we have time for, but we want to thank Mark so much for this wonderful conversation and what you have open for us. And we are going to help get this book out there because it's just amazing. It really, truly is. What a combination of humor and soul and technology and spunk and everything one needs, you know, and deep knowledge. 10-minute break, and we will be back.
Okay.
We'll send a mic over to Michelle.
Oh, I can get back.
Okay, so we have quite the variety of items for fundraising today. We have Meltaways, we have Nut Mix, we have candy bars, both C's and World's Finest. We have Welch's Fruit Snacks, and we have entertainment coupon books, and we have various auction items.
Okay.
And I think I remembered. Oh, and just to let you know, we have the tech grant application up online, but if you want a copy of it, I have a few copies.
Exactly.
Thank you.
That's right.
It's just crazy.
I agree with you.
And I understand all this. I understand all the
content. Oh, yeah. How could I forget? We also have Cookies of the Month fundraiser for Tech Grant. Thank you. Oh, we've got almond cookies, Toll House chocolate chip with walnut cookies, and almond biscotti cookies.
No, and you're doing great.
Thank you.
You too.